Hello and welcome to The Wire Weekly, the best stories of the week from some of the daily episodes of The Wire. I'm Roderick Chambers at 2SERFM in Sydney. Thanks so much for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Coming up on The Wire Weekly today...
Machetes are pretty easy to make. Anyone with a bit of metal and an angle grinder can make one. There are so many different bladed weapons out there that even if people no longer carry machetes, they'll carry something else.
The Victorian government has scrambled to put in some new laws to prevent the use of machetes after another crime spree on the streets of Melbourne. We take a look at some of these machete crimes and find out whether these laws are going to be effective. Stay tuned for all of this and more coming up on The Wire Weekly. But first, the national split from the coalition and the two parties are officially back together. The initial fallout centred on the Nationals' unwillingness to change their policies on nuclear energy, the Regional Future Fund, regional telecommunications and reducing the powers of the supermarket giants. Perry Livingston-Slade asked former Deputy Prime Minister and Nationals MP Michael McCormack what the reunification of the two parties means for the Nationals' four key policies.
Well, the Liberals have agreed in principle with those four key policy areas: with nuclear, with divestiture, with the regional fund and with the universal service obligations as far as telecommunications are concerned. So we'll go forward now, united together, to form a credible opposition, and certainly the Australian public can be confident that we'll be doing our jobs every hour of every day to make sure that this bad government gets held accountable.
You've held very senior positions in the past. Are you disappointed that you missed out on a shadow ministry portfolio? And do you have any future leadership ambitions?
Yes, and we'll see, is the answer to that question, that double barrel question. Yes, I am disappointed. Look, you wouldn't be, you know, you'd be telling fibs if you said anything other than, but I still think I've got the experience to contribute. I still think I've got the drive and energy and know-how, and I'll be doing that from the backbench. But future leadership ambitions, look, David Littleproud is the leader at the moment, and certainly you never rule yourself out of contention, because the moment you say to a journalist, to a reporter, that no, I'm never ever again, is the moment you get that tape replayed, when in fact people are tapping on the shoulder saying, can you run again? So look, we'll see what happens. Look, David is the leader. He's doing the best job he can do. We'll see what happens. And I just want the Nationals and the Liberals to now work towards a common goal, and that is defeating Labor. But we need to listen. We need to conduct our reviews of where the election went so badly wrong. Certainly the Liberals do. We retained all our lower house seats as far as the Nationals are concerned, but there were still missteps made, and we need to have a good hard look at ourselves, at our policies, at where we need to be in 3 years' time to get the public's faith back in us, to ensure that we are a credible opposition, a united opposition to what, as I say again, I think will be a very bad government, certainly for the next 3 years.
And as you said, it is very much the Liberal side of the coalition which needs to win back its previously held seats to win back government. Will the Nationals support the creating of policies that will help win back these metropolitan seats?
We'll work with the Liberals closely. We'll make sure that our regional people don't get left behind. That's the important thing. I mean, I think all parties could learn a thing or three from the way the National Party works. The work we do in between elections, we've now won all of our lower house seats, our House Representative seats, for six elections in a row under four leaders, under Warren Truss, Barnaby Joyce, myself, and now David Littleproud. That's something I think that we can be very proud of, something that other parties could learn a thing or three from. Now, we'll work closely with the Liberals. What we don't want to do is blow the show up. I mean, that would be counterproductive to what we need to be, and that is a credible, united opposition.
Significant names such as Jane Hume, Sarah Henderson and Barnaby Joyce have all been left out of the shadow cabinet. Do you think the coalition leadership has been successful in allocating the right people for each portfolio?
Well, time will tell, but certainly people who do get left out are always going to be disappointed. That's human nature. But you know what? We've all still got our jobs. The senators have got their senators' jobs. The lower house members who have left out are still members for their various electorates, and that's their first and foremost duty, is to represent those electorates that people in them are fiercely and proudly and passionately in the federal parliament. Now, there are people out there today who've, you know, their livelihoods have been wrecked by the floods in northern New South Wales, people who are mopping up, you know, inches of mud out of their houses. They're the ones I'm feeling for. There are farmers who are worried that they might not get follow-up rains here in southern New South Wales, and concerned that they may not be able to continue to grow the world's food and best food and fibre that that we produce as a nation. So, you know, they're not sure where their next paycheck is coming from. The politicians do know where their next paychecks are coming from. And look, it's just our jobs now is to represent the people that we're sent to Canberra to do a job for, to represent them the best we can possibly do, and that's what I'll be doing. That's what my focus is and always has been.
Michael McCormack, Nationals MP and member for Riverina, speaking there with Perry Livingston-Slade. We've been hearing about the increased risk of measles around the world, with vaccination programs being defunded from the Trump US administration. And just last week, news of a poliovirus type 2 outbreak in Papua New Guinea prompted immediate response from the PNG government. With the virus occurring in two vaccinated children, questions have been raised about how it was resurfaced and what ways it can be stopped. Deacon Percy asked Sumin Majumda, Chief Health Officer at the Burnet Institute, how this outbreak of polio occurred.
So polio or poliomyelitis is the disease caused by the poliovirus. This is a virus that is close to eradication in the world, but has re-emerged recently in many settings. This has been detected in Papua New Guinea, and it was detected in what we call environmental or wastewater sampling in two locations in the two biggest cities in the country. Following those detections in the wastewater, there was testing done in young children who are at highest risk, and some cases were found of confirmed poliovirus. Luckily, those children were immunized, so they were not sick. And since then, there has been further surveillance or looking for cases and an expanded program of response.
And you mentioned that both of those children were vaccinated for polio. So how might this new strain have infected them?
It's actually not the what we call the wild virus, which is the strain that was originally spreading around the world. This is what we call a vaccine-derived strain of polio. What happens there is when we vaccinate with the oral polio vaccine, which is given by drops into a mouth for four doses for a young child. This vaccine provides protection through the immune system in the gut, but sometimes the weakened virus can escape into the water and sanitation systems, and it can actually also potentially spread when the vaccination rate itself is not high. In PNG, childhood immunisation rates currently are around about 50%, and they need concerted effort to get them up.
And you mentioned the oral vaccine, and I believe the other type is the inactivated vaccine. What differences do they have, and which is more likely to prevent vaccine-derived infections?
Both have got their pros and cons. In Australia, we started with the inactivated vaccine in the 1950s. We then moved with the rest of the world to the oral vaccine, which is thought to give stronger protection and immunity. And then we've switched back to the inactivated or the injectable vaccine because it can be combined with other childhood vaccines. There is an issue with delivery of the vaccines where the oral one is easier to give at scale. And traditionally, that's been used in outbreak responses. But because we're seeing many more of these vaccine-derived polio outbreaks, there's been about 40 countries in 2024 that have reported them. There are only two countries that have the wild polio virus, which are Afghanistan and Pakistan. There is a move to now switch back to the inactivated polio vaccine, which can target these vaccine-derived strains.
So Papua New Guinea faced a similar vaccine-derived outbreak of poliovirus type 1 back in 2018, and the government worked quickly both then and now to contain both outbreaks. What can be learned from the government's response to prevent outbreaks in other countries?
I do commend the PNG government's swift response on getting on top of, firstly, the 2018 vaccine-derived outbreak, where coverage got up to around 97%, and they do rounds of what we call supplemental immunisation. And again, this time there was quite a quick response, and the government's had support of multilateral and bilateral partners, including Australia and the Australian government, to support the response that's being stood up now, an immunisation campaign vaccine will roll out in the coming weeks. So what's needed is, you know, and these are lessons for all epidemics or pandemics, as listeners will be aware, as a result of COVID-19, how we need to strengthen these systems and prevent infectious diseases threats from circulating, because they don't respect borders. So surveillance is key. It needs to start at the community level. Having then a pillar of prevention, and in this case for polio, it's immunization, and having immunization rates high is really key. In Australia, this is a problem. We've recently been seeing reports and data that shows our immunization rates in Australia are dripping below the 95% thresholds, which is compromised herd immunity for a diseases such as measles. So that is really important. Then there's the response side of things. When you pick something up, that you can swiftly swing into gear. So you need to have teams that are ready to do that, or a model where you can use the routine services to deliver a response. Infectious diseases outbreaks and pandemics are becoming more frequent through factors such as environmental degradation from climate change, from geopolitical issues. So when health systems get weak, these threats emerge.
What measures does Australia have in place currently to prevent a similar outbreak?
Australia is well protected against poliovirus with that immunisation rates being high, and we've not had a major outbreak since the 1960s. We do need to ensure in the communities that might be at higher risk or have lower access to services. The other thing that underpins all of these measures that I'm talking about is really deep engagement and trust built with communities to deliver health services. So without that, you know, it's not just having a vaccine, it's vaccination and working with people to take up that intervention.
Sumin Majumdar, Chief Health Officer at the Burnet Institute, speaking there with Deacon Percy. Victoria has become the first Australian state to ban the sale of all machetes. It comes after a stabbing incident in the Melbourne Northland shopping centre over the weekend, where several people have been charged with multiple offences. The total ban means there will be no exemptions on buying machetes until September, when new laws come into effect in the state. Jessica O'Brien has this story.
The owning of machetes is currently regulated in Australia, with people needing a valid reason or lawful excuse to have one. Despite lots of high-profile incidents and media coverage about knife crime nationwide, Dr. Samara McFedrin, Principal Research Fellow at Griffith University, said it's tough to get a clear idea of how common knife crime is.
We're not really seeing evidence of a crisis or an epidemic. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't be concerned. It just means that we need to take a measured and proportional response.
Although the Victorian government responded quickly after the incident in Melbourne on the weekend, Dr. McFedrin said banning machetes isn't an effective way of reducing violence.
When there's a high-profile violent incident, politicians need to be seen to be doing something. But the trouble is that there's a huge difference between being seen to be doing something and actually doing something effective that will genuinely reduce violence over the longer term.
Dr. McFedrin said there's lots to consider in how this ban will logistically and practically work.
Lots and lots of people own machetes for very legitimate purposes. Agriculture, gardening, camping and so on. What level of police time and resources is going to go into enforcing this ban in Victoria? Will it be criminalising people who have done nothing wrong and would never cause harm to others? How will people go about getting a permit to own a machete in Victoria?
In addition to this ban, there's also law changes coming into effect in the state in September.
Machetes are pretty easy to make. Anyone with a bit of metal and an angle grinder can make one. There are so many different bladed weapons out there that even if people no longer carry machetes, they'll carry something else.
This highlights the issue of a government focusing on and banning a particular type of weapon, like a machete, rather than addressing violence more holistically.
It distracts attention away from asking why are people arming themselves and going armed in public to begin with. We're not very good at asking or answering those questions because they're very uncomfortable questions. And they require us to move beyond these very simplistic, almost childish responses like banning things.
When it comes to violence, Dr. McFedrin said our politicians are used to doing what police tell them to do, and that this isn't a good way to make effective policies.
Just because we go to police when violence occurs doesn't mean we should go to police to get the solutions to violence. Police typically respond to violence by saying we need more police powers and more laws. Sometimes that can be an appropriate part of a broader response. But all too often, what we see is that politicians simply say, police have told us we should do this, so we'll do it. And that's it.
To make more effective change, she suggested politicians focus on early intervention and rehabilitation, and in future, that they talk to a wider range of stakeholders and communities and look more broadly at what the evidence suggests.
That would be a big step forward for politicians to take. Whether they're brave enough to do that, I don't know.
Dr. Samara McFedrin, Principal Research Fellow at Griffith University, ending that report by Jessica O'Brien. The Tasmanian government has released draft legislation to allow the $945 million Macquarie Point Stadium in Hobart to proceed, bypassing the usual planning commission process. The cost has risen by $170 million, and the project is tied to Tasmania securing an AFL team licence. Recently confirmed Tasmanian Senator Jackie Lambie has been scathing of the cost to Tasmanians, particularly as it won't be serving northern Tasmania, where she is located. Moamina Shakur asked Dr. Robert Hortle from the University of Tasmania how easy it will be for the government to get this legislation passed through the state parliament.
On the weekend, we had elections in the Legislative Council in Tassie, in our upper house. And so two of the people who won seats at that are pro-stadium, and one of them is a returning member who's against the stadium. But it does make the maths a little bit difficult in the Legislative Council for the government if they want to be able to pass this legislation. So in the lower house, they'll be able to pass it with the support of the Labor Party, who have backed the stadium as well. But then in the upper house, they'll need to win over at least one of the independents, and they'll be working pretty hard on a few of them to try and convince them to vote for any legislation that comes through.
Why is the government trying to bypass the usual planning process for the Macquarie Point Stadium? And what are the risks of doing that?
So it's been a pretty long and convoluted planning process. And we kind of need to go back to 2022 to understand some of the origins. So initially the government passed legislation to create a special project of state significance planning process. And that allowed them to go around some of the regular planning rules. So what that meant was that the stadium development has had to be assessed by an independent expert panel instead of through the usual Hobart City Council planning process. And so recently that independent panel from the Tasmanian Planning Commission put out its draft report. The draft report was pretty critical of various factors around the stadium. And so the government has instead looked at putting forward some enabling legislation that would let it fast track the stadium through and kind of bypass this special planning process that they had set up.
The stadium cost has gone up by about $170 million, making it almost a $1 billion project. How can I guess the government reassure it doesn't keep going up?
Yeah, so the cost has been going up, as you identified, pretty consistently. And part of that recently has been driven by the requirements of Cricket Tasmania and Cricket Australia. So they've had to change some design features around that. And the new costs include a whole bunch of other estimates for things like, you know, the media screens in the stadium and various other bits and pieces. So the federal government initially said it would chip in $240 million. The AFL is putting in $15 million. And initially the Tasmanian government government said that they weren't going to put in not a red cent more than $375 million of taxpayers' money. So if people are managing to follow along and do their sums there, that leaves a $315 million shortfall. And the Tasmanian government initially was looking at financing that through public-private partnerships, but they've recently said they don't want to do that anymore. So instead, they will be looking to get that $315 million as a loan through the Macquarie Point Development Corporation, which is a government-owned business.
What would be the benefits of this project in the long run?
So proponents of the stadium hope that it'll have a range of benefits for things like elite sports pathways in Tasmania. It will offer more space for big functions, so hopefully increase Tasmania's attractiveness as a destination for conferences, also for concerts and so on. They expect that big international acts will be able to come and play. So they're really hoping for a whole range of kind of economic, sporting and cultural impacts to get return on the investment.
I mean, given the scale of this project, what standards should be, I guess, met to ensure the environmental, ecological sustainability while putting together this, this stadium?
Yeah, I think the independent planning process that was underway was really important, and the draft report from that independent panel that I mentioned found a lot of concerns with the stadium. So things like they said there would be significant negative impacts on the heritage aspect of the area. So that's things like sight lines from the cenotaph, which is nearby. So that's where we have the dawn service, for example, on Anzac Day. There's also some environmental concerns around stormwater being released from the site, some potential issues around even evacuation in case of emergency, because it's kind of jammed in between the river and a pretty major road.
Dr. Robert Hortle from the University of Tasmania speaking there with Momina Shakur. Mark Fennell has been widely acclaimed for his podcast and TV series Stuff the British Stole, and his latest investigation is into the romantic and gilded world of fine wines. In his new audio series Corked, he finds that greed, money and power lie just under the surface of the projected allure of the opaque, warm, esoteric atmosphere of the fine wine industry. I caught up with Mark Fennell and asked him what attracted him to travelling the world tasting fine wines for an audio series.
Well, I feel like the answer is somewhat embedded in the question, that one. I think actually for me, I'm not a wine expert. I'm actually kind of a wine idiot in a way. Like I know and can navigate food, and I've covered food stories in the past. But wine is a bit of a black box to me. There are other people that are really good at it. The starting point for me was actually the understanding the job, right? So if you've been to a fancy restaurant, you'll have encountered a sommelier, the person who's an expert in wine that brings you wine. To become a master sommelier, it turns out, is actually one of the hardest jobs in the world. There's less than 300 of them around the world. There are more astronauts than there are master sommeliers. And the reason for that is that it takes years. You have to progress through a course. It's administered, at least in the US, by the Court of Master Sommeliers Americas. You have to do multiple tests. And one of the final tests is a blind tasting, where you are presented with six wines and you have to not only to get what the wine is, but you also have to kind of tell the story of it. You have to use nothing but taste to kind of work out where the grape's from, what year it's from. It's an incredible feat. That alone was intriguing. But actually what the hook was actually when I realized that in 2018, everybody that went for this incredibly hard to get accreditation was summarily cancelled. They were stripped of their title, and most of them had no idea why. And it's what they do from that moment that explodes this world of fine wine that most of us, you know, didn't even know existed, but actually for the people who are in it, it's a huge disaster.
Wow. I mean, let me just, I've looked up one of our more famous wines, and I just, let me read this to you. Rich, deep tones of mahogany and cigar box, sweet oak spices, dusty notes, summer berries, baking spice and fresh pastries. Now, that's just the aroma. The taste has got even more. And this is one of Penfold's famous wines, Penfold's 389. It's something that's very subjective in a way, but on the other hand, you've got this incredible imagination that you come to with tasting a wine, don't you?
Yeah, so one of the people we met actually was a wine prodigy, right? That's how I've framed him. So there's this guy who's working in Napa Valley in the US. And as a child, he started taking wine appreciation classes, like literally as a kid, like like 14, 15 years old. And he said this really interesting thing to me, because I read those descriptions and then I taste the wine and I struggle. I struggle to make the connection, like I think a lot of people do. I struggle to you know, work out where the cigar and the mahogany is. Yeah, and he said,
but you nod sagely, don't you, with the other people
well, this
around
is the thing,
you?
Right? We all sit there going, yes, of course I can. Yes. You know, and I would say a good 70% of us are like, I'm faking this. But this is a guy who he said something to me. He's like, when he was growing up, when he knew that wine was what he wanted to do, he would do this thing where he would smell something like fresh cut grass, or he would smell something like, you know, summer dew. And he would be very intentional about locking that scent away in his head, knowing that it was something he would have to call back on. And that was like, I'd never really considered that this is a muscle you could exercise and you could flex at certain points in history. And to kind of accelerate yourself through that process, you have to have a wine tasting group, you have to have a mentor, you have to fly yourself to the different tastings. It's a huge outlay. And the mentorship part of the equation is really important, because that, as we go through the series, we realize that mentorship relationship between people that have power and people don't has been abused. And that's core to part of the story of, as it unfolds.
Right. So people have been able to game the system, have they?
People have been taken advantage of within the system. And there are people who tried to change the outcome, sometimes with really good intentions, but actually the result was a disaster.
Mark Fennell, Walkley Award-winning journalist and documentary maker, explaining a bit about his new Audible series on the wine industry entitled Corked. And that's it for us on The Wire Weekly this week, but we're going to be back again next week, and of course The Wire will be broadcast each weekday as well. The Wire Weekly is produced in the studios of Radio 2SER 107.3 in Sydney, in the country of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. It is broadcast nationwide on the Community Radio Network with the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. I'm Roderick Chambers. It's been great to be with you. Stay well.